This is a Dharmanet presentation.
So for this evening's Dhamma talk, I wanted to talk a little bit about the path of Buddhism, you know, the idea of the path and the goal. So when we talk about the path of Buddhism, we call the middle way. The Buddha used this metaphor where he's talking about the Noble Eightfold Path. And the idea of the spiritual path or spiritual journey is so ingrained as a metaphor that it's very difficult to even think about or talk about spiritual practice without using some kind of metaphor that way. Like even if I say the word practice, actually the Pali word that we're translating by practice is patibada, which is just another word meaning a path or a journey. Well, the magga is the path. You have like the brahmacharya, you know, again, the spiritual journey, spiritual wandering. I hope we have translated as the holy life, but literally it's like a spiritual journey. And when the Buddha explained the Eightfold Path, of course, they always mention the factors of the Eightfold Path, the right view, right intention, right speech. Can everyone remember the eight factors? Okay, let's get them in order, okay? Number one, right view. Number two? Number three? Oh, come on. Right effort. No, we already have right livelihood. Mindfulness. Right samadhi. Okay, very good. Well, reasonably good, anyway. So that's good. So these are the things. But of course, when we forget that when we talk about these things, of course, it's not actually a journey, is it? Right? It's just a metaphor. Yeah. So one of the things about the use of that thing as a metaphor is that, of course, spiritual life isn't actually quite like a journey, is it? I mean, it is at the end of the day just a metaphor. You know, I've just been on a journey, and we started at a certain time, and we wandered across Bihar and Uttar Pradesh, and bounced up and down. I mean, some places you're moving, the total quantity of motion vertically is greater than your horizontal motion, right? You sort of what really struck me about that kind of journey, you know, what really struck me about that was this one stretch of road between Vaishali and Kusinara, where they had like an expressway. So they kind of raised the road and you got this expressway. But the expressway was just as full of potholes and rubbish as the actual other road, right? You're just bouncing up and down and so. So you do that for a kind of a while and then it ends, right? And then that's a kind of a journey. But the spiritual practice isn't quite like that, is it? Because spiritual practice, you keep going. And, you know, if you look at those factors of the Eightfold Path, you think, well, are those things that have a start and a beginning? Is that a beginning and an end? Right? Right view. Is that something that has a beginning and an end? Look. Kind of, right? I mean, kind of in the sense it has a beginning in the sense that you maybe hear the Dhamma or hear the teachings, and for the first time you maybe recognize something. Yeah? For me, when I went to do my first retreat in Thailand, and you go and they teach you about impermanence and anicca dukkha anatta, impermanent suffering and not self, and sort of explain what these things mean. And so you've got the beginnings of kind of right view is there, right? So in a sense, you can say, well, that was the beginning, right? Except it's not really a beginning, because actually there were lots of different parts of Buddhism or Buddhist ideas or what we'd consider right view which were already present. Right? I mean, for example, I already had the view that of morality or ethics, that it's a good idea to do good things, right? And I already was trying to practice harmlessness, right? And so on. And even a lot of things like how the mind is this sort of force which helps to construct the world, and how the world that we live in is a world which we are subjectively determining, and these kinds of things are ideas that I'd come across before I encountered Buddhism. So actually, even though we can sort of point to a date when that journey of right view starts, actually it's not really, it's just a sort of, it's something that's been going on your whole life, really. And you look back and you think, well, actually as soon as you're born, you're starting to learn. And you're starting to learn about concepts like self and other, right? About caring, yeah? About responsibility, about cause and effect. And these all sort of come in and inform what you're doing as right view. The same thing with other factors of the path, like the practice of, say, right intention, yeah? Practice of loving kindness, letting go, compassion. Yeah? So these are the emotional motivations and forces that lie behind the choices that we make. And so again, if you encounter Buddhism or you encounter the Dhamma, you might sort of become more aware of these things, you might understand them more clearly, you might want to practice them more deliberately or more consciously. But it's hardly as if that's the first time you've ever felt compassion or the first time you've ever felt about letting go of anything, right? I mean, they're all an ordinary part of human experience. So it's very difficult to kind of point to a beginning stage of these practices. And similarly, it's kind of hard to point to an end of them as well, isn't it? One of the controversies in spiritual circles is whether we should have an idea of a kind of a goal. If we look in the Buddhist text, you find there's this kind of ambiguity about the notion of a goal. And, you know, in many places when the Buddha talked about it, he talked about it in quite a straightforward way, right, that we're practicing in order to realize Nibbana. And he called Nibbana the Atta. The word Atta is a very important word in Pali, which means literally like the goal or the purpose of something. Yeah? And so Nibbana is the Atta for which we are striving. Right? So in some ways it's very kind of straightforward. Again, the metaphor, we're here, there's a path we have to go along, and then we get to the ending, which is our goal. Right? But of course, again, it's just a metaphor. So the goal is not actually something which is over there and outside or anything like that. The goal is ending of greed, hatred, and delusion. Right? So in a sense, it's not something that you can strive for. And greed, hatred, and delusion are just conditions. Right? So how can you strive to end conditions? Well, conditions end themselves. There's nothing that you have to do to make them end. Right? Greed comes up when there's the causes for greed to be there, and when the causes for greed to be there aren't there, it goes. Anger is there because there's certain conditions that give rise to it. Fuel it, and when the conditions are there are gone, anger passes away. Delusion's there because there are conditions for delusion. When there's conditions for it, the mind will be confused and deluded, lack of understanding. And when those conditions for delusion are gone, the mind will see clearly. So the idea that you have some kind of practice which makes these things come to an end is a metaphor and has some usefulness, but also has some kind of limitations. So, on the whole, in Buddhism, we do have an idea that there's an end goal, right? We do believe that we're practicing for nibbana, and that there's a sense that perfection is possible. Yeah? That there's a state of perfection, and when you're perfect, you don't need to keep on practicing. Yeah? So this is again a kind of bit of a double-edged sword, really, because on the one hand, you can feel, well, there is a kind of perfection, but I'm very imperfect, right? That's how most of us feel most of the time. So then how do we respond to our own imperfection? Well, what the Buddha wanted you, how he would have wanted you to respond was to say, well, look, okay, I'm still suffering, I'm still imperfect, but there is this path, and I can understand what that path is. I understand what right view is. I understand what right intention is. I understand what right speech is. And I can do that. I can understand what right livelihood is, right action. I can do these things. They're actually meaningful things which are part of that spiritual practice towards that perfection. And they're things which I can do and understand right now, and which are not dependent on the grace of God. They're not dependent on getting some special blessing from the Buddha or from the monks or something like that. It's not dependent on being born under a certain star sign. Yeah? It's not dependent on getting the right kind of tattoo that's going to give you some protection or something. All it means is just living your life in a good way, being aware of your mind, being mindful, and directing your mind to follow that path. So this is how the Buddha wanted us to respond. But if we're going to be honest, we're going to say we don't always respond in that kind of way, do we? Because sometimes we respond with despair. Yeah? It's just too much. Yeah, practice is just too much. It's just it's just ridiculous. How can I let go of all these things? I've got so many attachments, so many things that are, and you get so overwhelmed. You can't even cope with what breakfast cereal you're going to buy, right? Much less being able to think what how am I going to get to Nibbana, right? Yeah, and you're thinking, it's just too much. So this is one thing, and so because sometimes Nibbana feels very remote and feels almost inhuman, you know. I remember my mum said that something like that to me once, you know, that you know, you've got to have some sort of greed and stuff like that, otherwise you're not really human. that's how we define ourselves. So you... Is Nirvana like heaven?
Yeah.
I hope not, like with the harps and stuff. I mean, harps are all right, but it's a bit boring after a while.
What
Nirvana exactly feels like. Peace, yeah. Nirvana is peace. Nirvana doesn't have anything to it. Yeah? So again, this is the kind of thing. As soon as we start to give some content to Nirvana, right? You start to define it, then it starts to become something which is... Which again, it becomes imperfect again, because we can never really capture these things with words. No? Maybe. Yeah. But just peace is probably the best way of thinking about Nibbana. Yeah. And freedom. These are the metaphors that the Buddha used. Well, the one that I really like to me that's really meaningful thinking about Nibbana is this metaphor of freedom that the Buddha used. He said, for example, like a man who's locked up in jail. And when you're locked in jail, you can't do what you want to do. You know, you can't go for a walk. You can't eat what you want.
We are locked in our own jail,
yeah. And we are imprisoned whatever we do. And greed, hatred, and delusion is the prison. Right? And we fool ourselves that we can be free and we can have some choice, and we're just sort of carving out a little niche for ourselves in that prison. And then you think that you're sort of comfortable because, you know, you managed to get a decent mattress and because you, you know, made friends with the guard and he gets you a supply of cigarettes. And so you're making your cell a little bit nicer and your prison life a little bit better. And you forget that you're actually just in jail. And then one day you get released. And that day you step out of the gates. And what does that feel like? And the thing is, it doesn't feel like anything. Right? Because ten people can get released from jail and they all feel something different. And they all actually go and do completely different things, right? For one person it means, oh, I'll go down to the beach and go for a swim. Another person it's, oh, I'll go and get completely drunk. Another one it's, I'll go and be with my family. Yeah? And it's another one it's, you know, it can be so many different things. Somebody else just wanders around, just like nothing. They're just so happy to be free. So the actual experience, the reality of it, the content of it, is completely different for each person. Yeah? But it all has that unifying flavor, which is the flavor of freedom. Yeah? So you can't... But that flavor of freedom isn't anything. Yeah? It's just the lack of the oppression that you're experiencing before. Yeah, so this is why it's very hard to pin it down.
Mm.
I would imagine too. Yeah. So we have this goal or this idea in the mind of Nibbana, but sometimes it feels very distant, and so we have that feeling of despair or feeling that it's kind of irrelevant. And a lot of people, even people who are Buddhists, and I think even most traditional Buddhists, the idea of Nibbana is really kind of irrelevant for most people. You know, I mean, maybe it's kind of in the background as a kind of an idea or something, but most people don't really know what it means. And it's not sort of a meaningful kind of motivating force in people's lives. Because the other problem that you get is when you, is the opposite problem from then despair, which is the proud realization, yes, I have realized Nibbana. Ah, so I am enlightened. I am perfected. And that's a real problem. So if you imagine that you're free, or you imagine that you're enlightened, then it's not necessarily a bad thing in the sense that, you know, you can be quite happy and so on. But it becomes an obstacle to your progress, right? You get kind of locked into this kind of idea and you get very kind of defensive about it. You can see, again, this is very common in Buddhist circles and in spiritual circles. So the solution, or I think the approach we should be taking, is neither that Nibbana is something which is so distant and so remote that it's unimaginable, nor the idea that, you know, it's something which is very simple and very easy, but the idea that, the important point is that the path is so powerful that even that profound goal of Nibbana is something that can be achieved. It's not. We shouldn't be trying to diminish the reality of Nibbana. We shouldn't be able to try to say that, you know, it's actually something which is quite simple or quite trivial or something like that. It is profound, and from a worldly perspective or something, it's incredibly difficult and incredibly rare to realize that. But it's only possible because of the true power of the Eightfold Path. And so this, if you look carefully, in Buddhist circles and different kind of groups and different people and so on, you always find that there's this tendency. Some groups will sort of say, oh, they kind of tend to dismiss the notion of enlightenment. Oh, it's not really possible to get enlightenment, or enlightenment doesn't really exist, and so on. And this happens a lot in different circles. In traditional Buddhism, you find this a lot. people don't really believe in Nibbana, don't really believe in enlightenment. Similar also in a lot of the secular Buddhist circles also, they kind of dismiss this idea that you can get enlightened, dismiss this idea of perfection. Or people say that actually it's quite easy to get enlightened, right? So, you know, you can go along and do a retreat for 10 days or a month or something like that, and then you can get enlightened by doing this retreat and so on. And, you know, I saw an interview once with this, teacher in America, and he's like, oh, you know, all the guys sitting around this table in this coffee shop, we're all enlightened, you know, and this kind of thing. So it's even possible and unattainable, or else it's no big deal, really, you know. And you know, once you're enlightened, I mean, you still need to go to therapy and stuff like that. And it's Californian enlightenment, but if you look at actually what's going on, if you look under the surface at these different people and what they're talking about, what they're saying, it always comes back to the path, right? You always look at how they're talking about the path and where the practice goes, and you'll always find that what they've done is they've diminished and watered down the path. Right? All the different aspects of the path have been explained away. Right? We've explained away why we don't really need to. Oh, you don't really need to get the precept against not drinking, for example. Right? We kind of explained that away, and that whole kind of renunciation thing, and monks and stuff, and nuns and things used to do that. No, but we don't. You know, we're in modern times. You don't really need to do that, and so you kind of explain away that kind of thing. And right view. Well, it's not as if you really need to actually study the suttas and know what the Buddha taught and that kind of thing. You know, the Buddha taught about impermanence and not self. But you know, not self is really just a way of talking, and the Buddha didn't really mean that there's not a self, you know, and so on and on it goes, and you realize actually every part of the path has been explained away subtly, little bit by little bit, right? And it all sounds quite reasonable, actually, right? On individual levels, there's a point to that. You know, it's not that what they're saying is wrong or bad or anything like that, but at the end of the day, everything's been watered down. And I haven't even begun to talk about, obviously, in the meditation practice. You know, you see that, of course, very strongly. Some movements in Buddhism explain away meditation altogether, right? You don't have to meditate. Many different movements like that, though. This is kind of Abhidhamma movements in Thailand where they say, you know, you just have to study Abhidhamma. You don't have to meditate. Other people will say, you can meditate, but you don't need jhanas, right? So this is, of course, a big kind of deal. You don't need jhanas, you just need to, you know, practice mindfulness meditation, and that's good enough. And so always this tendency to take away things from the Eightfold Path, water things down. Oh, yeah. And so, to me, what all of that is nothing more than a lack of faith in what the Buddha was actually teaching, right? The lack of faith, and think that yes, this, the goal of Nibbana is something which is incredibly profound, and which, compared to our lives, where we live and what we do, yes, it is very difficult. It's only possible because of the power of the Eightfold Path, right? The full power of the Eightfold Path, right? All of the factors of the Eightfold Path, all of them in their fullness, and all of them working together. That is the only reason why we can even vaguely begin to think that we can overcome these forces of greed, hatred, and delusion, which are so deeply ingrained. These incredibly powerful forces. There's nothing more powerful in the world than greed, hatred, and delusion, yeah? Except for the Eightfold Path. And so when we come back and we realize this path, all of those things in it, the right view, right intention, the right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right samadhi. If we can look at those things, at least initially, just from a point of view of just sort of raising them into consciousness and asking about them, asking what do these things mean, how important are they, are they kind of realities, right? And of course, you know, one of the most incredible and most powerful things about the Eightfold Path is how straightforward it is. Yeah? There's nothing exceptional about it, except for the fact that it's completely unexceptional, right? I mean, if you look at how different religions, including Buddhism, as it's evolved as a religion, how many things that you put into it, right? I mean, we were just in Bangkok yesterday, or the day before yesterday, in Ayutthaya. I went to some of the old temples and different historical sites and things like that. And, you know, you're going around these places and there's these huge Buddha images. And then there's all these, like, Kali and Ganesh and four-faced Brahma and all of the, you know, you go to this one and you make an offering and this is you get for good study exam results, and then there's this one you go and you get wealth, and you go to this one and you go to Kali for if you've got like black magic or something like that and protection from curses and all of these kinds of, right? And all of these things that we keep on wanting to put into our religious and spiritual life, again, to me, all of those things are nothing but a lack of faith in the actual Dhamma that the Buddha taught. And if you really understand what the Eightfold Path is and what the Buddha was talking, then all of those things just become a bit silly, really. You know, why people are doing all those things. And the Eightfold Path is so powerful and is so transformative. So this is why when we look at that and we take that, we can take each part of it. And you can see... each part of that path has so much scope for for improvement, for perfection. Right? So we may think that, you know, our where we're at, you know, we don't know how we can do more. We don't know what else we can do. And so often when people conceive of practice and they want to deepen their practice, they think of, you know, I'm going to find some time to go away and retreat, or I'm going to meditate more, or do this or do that, and they don't even realize actually the first five factors of the Eightfold Path has got nothing to do with doing meditation. Actually, right view, right speech, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood. Even if you're not a meditator, you can still be practicing all of these five factors of the Eightfold Path, and you can still be deepening them, perfecting them, and you can still keep on doing that for the rest of your life. Yeah? And this is not a journey that you're going to just get right over a weekend. Yeah? You might think that your sila is okay, right? You know, and you look back and you think, oh, you know, I tell the truth, I don't kill things, you know, I don't drink and stuff. And then there comes that time, that crunch time, when you have to say that thing that you really, really, really don't want to say. and that's the point that your sila is going to be tested. Yeah? That's the point that you see how actually powerful and how strong are these things. And so these things are continually tested and refined over your whole life, and it's something which grows with you as your life continues. You know, one of the things that you see in people's lives is, you know, we have this idea in the West, we talk about this midlife crisis, right? So you get to the midlife crisis, and what's the midlife crisis? Well, the midlife crisis is basically that you've got everything that you want, and it doesn't make you happy, right? That's basically it, isn't it? You know, you sort of grow up and you're thinking, oh, you know, degree, career, family, all of those things. And when you get those things and you start to get them, you're fantastic, right? You get into, get married and you have a family and you have a career or whatever. And then after you've been doing that for a while, you begin to realize, actually, that's kind of okay. Well, where do you go now? What actually is your aim? You know, I earn more money, buy a bigger house, buy, you know, go on a holiday. And you begin to realize, actually, that those goals, there's nothing wrong with those things, but they're limited, right? Because they're worldly things, so they have a limited benefit. And you realize actually that those things just by themselves are not going to make you happy. So they might be part of a life which is fulfilled and which leads to happiness, but just by themselves, that's not enough. And so this is where that notion of the spiritual life and that notion of a goal, which is so profound, right? It keeps on calling you out. It keeps on challenging you. It keeps on raising you to a new level. Yeah? Throughout your whole life, no matter what you do, no matter how deeply you practice, no matter how many retreats you go on, there's always something that can challenge you and something that can say, hang on, where am I actually going with this? What direction am I sending my mind in? Yeah. How can I go further on this path? How can I be more compassionate? You know, we never, you know, you might think, well, I'm doing okay because I haven't broken my precepts or something like that. But then you ask yourself, could I be more compassionate? Yeah? And probably, unless you're the Dalai Lama, you can probably say yes. And the Dalai Lama, I'm sure, would say he needs to be much more compassionate. So there's always this sense that the path is one of fulfillment and abundance. Like the words the Buddha used for the path are sevati, bhaveti, bhavali karoti, yeah? to cultivate it, to develop it, to make much of it. Yeah? And so it's something which should not be, it's not like we shouldn't be watering it down and making it, sort of packaging it to try to make it seem as it's just a kind of an easy thing. But we should think of it as a growth and as an abundance, so that every breath, every moment, every hour, every day, that we can fill our lives with the qualities of the Eightfold Path, and every life that every moment that we're doing that, we are experiencing right here and now, to some degree, that peace and that freedom and that joy, which is the freedom of Nibbana. And we experience that every time that we let go of a little bit of greed, hatred, and delusion. And we experience constantly, every day, that letting go of greed, hatred, and delusion. And we experience every day that little bit of freedom, that little bit of peace, that little bit of Nibbana. And as we continue with that path, we can gradually learn and gradually understand what that full letting go might be like. Until, of course, one day when it happens, and all of those factors of the Eightfold Path are there. Right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right samadhi. That day when we realize we don't need to explain any of these things away.
Sometimes when you're like depressed, you kind of lose control of your action.
But again, you didn't answer my question. Is willpower and control, are they factors of the Eightfold Path? Ah, exactly. So don't worry about all those things. And then you look back and say, well, what actually are the factors of the Eightfold Path? Yeah? So if you find that you know, you maybe, as you say, you then get into a very bad mood, a very depressed mood, so then you can start to recognize that, understand it. Okay, well, obviously you've got maybe anger or aversion of some kind in your mind, maybe you have very low energy or something like that. And then you begin to understand, okay, well, when the mind is like that, then it tends to condition, as you said, wrong speech and so on and so forth. And that all comes from your mind. So at the very least, you can start to understand that. You can appreciate, okay, that's what's going on. I've got this bad mood, this bad mind states, and that's going to... So first thing you can do is just be a little bit restrained, okay, to recognize, oh, this is going to move in that direction. These kinds of things are going to happen. Second thing you can do is just to recognize that those states of mind are just conditions. Okay? And you just go through, and mind is always like that, and goes up and goes down. Sometimes it's just chemical, sometimes it's the time of day, whatever. Sometimes it's because of some psychological reason, or stress, or can be many different things.
You live in a fantasy for too long.
You've been in a fantasy for too long.
Yeah.
And then reality hits.
Then it'll destroy you back. You get depressed because you're living a fantasy.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're not very real.
But that's good. That's good depression then. That's the depression of reality. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Reality can be a shock sometimes. Yeah. But that's one of the reasons for then practicing meditation, especially things like metta meditation, because a metta meditation is that quality of gentleness, which I mentioned before, and that's something which is gives you an incredible confidence, because you know that there is a place of peace and of happiness and joy that you can find in your own heart, no matter what happens outside you. Yeah, and yes, you can still feel depressed and confused and so on, but you know that somehow inside yourself, you can find that place of happiness. Maybe not right now, right? Maybe if you're too emotional or something, it's difficult right now, but you know it's still there.